Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
This is Prison Pipeline from the studios of KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I'm Amy Johnson. Today I'll be airing audio from a performance called Shaping a Future, Life After Prison. Shaping a Future took place on October 29th, 2017 at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. This performance was free, open to the public, and the culmination of a series of writing workshops organized by Carol Imani and funded by the Regional Arts and Culture Council. Shaping a Future included monologues written and read by 9 individuals who had spent time in prison. They told stories of redemption and determination related to their reentry to society after prison. They also highlighted the failings of our criminal justice system. This is part 7, and it's the final episode. It includes the 9th monologue, written and read by Jackie. This is Long Time Coming.
I'd like to tell you a story about a little girl, bouncing around from place to place, never landing anywhere for too long, encountering different degrees of stress and trauma, all at a toxic level, and how those experiences shaped my existence. My story is about heartbreak, loss, and grief, but also about triumph, healing, and redemption. It's about how God can make miracle out of messes, and how He can transform your pain into your passion. I was born into this life to 2 people swimming in the midst of their dysfunction. My mom, having escaped a torrential and extremely violent relationship, and my father, trudging through a murky abyss of grief, having been dealt the blow of losing both parents to a senseless tragedy not many years before. Everything my father hated in life, he became. And with the odds stacked against their relationship, it's not hard to see how my parents didn't make it through the storm. They split before I got a good chance to know the man that brought me into this world. And sadly, God would call him to rest before that glorious day I would get a chance to stand before him as his only child and say, God, I love you and thank you for what you've done to bring me into this world. More importantly, I would say to him, I forgive you. Because of my own lived experience, I can truly identify how trauma can impact who we are and what we become. Thankfully, I still have my dear old mom here, graciously accepting my never-ending invitation to participate in events along the lines of these. Despite me having to beg, bribe, and barter, and sometimes drag her kicking and screaming, I still get her here. And after all that's said and done, through the stress and anxiety of dates and deadlines, we still manage to have a few laughs. And actually endless humor, accented by sometimes bizarre, but entertaining and unconventional spurts of growth, development, and healing. Not many moms would have the courage to be confronted with all that has taken place, especially if it's ugly. And even be willing to put that on the world, on display for the world to witness. And our story has so many twists and turns, it's almost a miracle that both of us are still alive, walking and talking, able to share about it, including for me the physical and sexual abuse I suffered, often due to neglect and the compounded traumas of being part of an invisible population of children of incarcerated parents. From a young age, I learned how to maneuver in the trenches of dysfunction, and developed an amazing set of skills to survive the politics of poverty and actually thrive. With hustlers and addicts as my mentors, I learned a lot of innovative ways to get things, And though my spirit was opposed to most of that, I felt driven by necessity, and that overrode any internal conflict that may have arisen inside of me. Learning these tactics also helped me dodge many assaults or distract perpetrators long enough for me to seek safety. In my youth, my criminal behaviors escalated, and I began acquiring new methods that brought me a substantial amount of money for a person my age. I quit school in eighth grade after I was raped, so I had nothing but time and anger to teach myself new ways to get money. When we moved back from Denver, my mom, who had been in recovery since leaving prison, ended up relapsing on drugs. We lost our house, and I had to start supporting myself at 15. I lived out of my storage unit for a year and continued to support myself through a life of crime. I always knew it was wrong, but fully accepted that I had no skills to live as a regular person. It's hard to fix a problem you don't understand. In retrospect, I realized that untreated trauma and undiagnosed mental health issues were the cause of many of my dangerous behaviors, including domestic and interpersonal violence. Growing up, watching my mom frequently getting her face bashed in, I created a sad set of boundaries for what I was going to accept into my own life and how I was going to battle abusive people. It's no wonder how I eventually ended up in prison after developing an addiction of my own, which transformed me from the victim to the perpetrator. One of my deepest challenges was going to be how do I mitigate my propensity to blame everyone else but myself, not realizing that if things were everybody else's fault, I had absolutely no power to change. Prison was a traumatic, dehumanizing experience. It was difficult to understand what was happening around me, but I was forced to learn the language and the politics of this strange new world. The institutional lighting sucked, and you could never fully turn it off. The sounds of change and large sets of jingling keys, slamming metal doors, constant chatter and yelling not only disrupts the peace, but also the spirit. Ironically, the prison experience mimicked many of my past relationships that were filled with domestic violence. Abusers, like prison itself, try to isolate you and exert absolute dominance over every aspect of your existence. They like to wear away at your ability to access your support networks with limited expensive phone systems that create barriers for people to keep in contact with their family members. Prison policies are hurtful and destructive. Common practices of public humiliation when you break a rule. Frequent demonstrations from staff that display the power differential. Constant reminders that they're the ones in charge. Verbally and abusive officers and practices that wear away at your self-esteem. The staff was also often rude and disrespectful to our visitors, as if they were trying to discourage them from ever visiting us at all. Along with that, there are constant searches of your belongings, often when you're not present. Can you imagine the feeling you get upon returning to find your things have been searched and spread all over your bed, items tipped over and torn into, spilling everywhere? After a long, hard day shift of working for less than a dollar a day. And to top all that off, there might be a disciplinary report outlining your rule violations and subsequent punishment. And all you may have done was put lotion in a shampoo bottle, which they call contraband, or had an extra piece of fruit, which we barely got, or had a set of colored pencils that you borrowed to color a birthday card for your kids, which is strictly forbidden. And it could be that an officer doesn't like you and is harassing and targeting you, pitting other staff against you, encouraging other officers to treat you in the same way. Imagine walking around with the tormented stress of heightened vigilance, being told, sit down, shut up, get away from me. Not being allowed to have any physical contact whatsoever, No hugs of reassurance from peers or simple shoulder rub affirming that we're going to make it out of this hellhole one day. And don't even get me started on the health services. Their practices are horrifying. It truly seems like when the correctional institution goes to hire a nurse or a doctor, part of their hiring criteria is a total lack of compassion and blatant indifference to our needs. Their practices teach you from the beginning not to come looking for them for medical attention because you won't find it there. I'd like to believe that the public is unaware of what goes on in these institutions, and not that our society's values reflect how we punish. I realize that fear and frenzies often fuel bad policies, but I often ask myself if anyone ever wonders why women go to prison, or anybody for that matter. Does society want people to rehabilitate when they send them away? Why does it criminalize communities of poverty and communities of color? Why is the U.S. our global jailer, outnumbering any other country in regards to prison populations? Do we really believe that we can incarcerate our way out of mental illness, untreated trauma, and poverty? Why do we have for-profit prisons? Why do we disenfranchise people after they get a felony and serve their time? I'd like to reimagine a system rebuilt from the ground up. I want this country to eliminate private prisons and the potential for systems to profit off our poor prosecution. I want restorative justice and programs that treat the source of why individuals encounter the justice system in the first place. The last time I was in prison, something changed for me. I remember that defining moment as I realized that my daughter was the same age as I was when my mom was in prison the last time. I remember how lonely and confused I was, how sad and desperate I was to be in her presence. And I remember that never-fading thought that I had when I was my daughter's age, that if I ever had kids, I would never abandon them this way. That stark reality hit me square between the eyes, and I felt a sinking anguish stir in the pit of my stomach because I had done exactly the thing that I swore I'd never do. Leave my kids in a cold, dark world to fend for themselves. Moments like these have the power to do two things. They can scare you into changing or smash you into smithereens, shredding any spark of motivation and reaffirming any negative core belief that you have within. Thankfully, I had the Lord's loving arms around me to cling to the hope of restoring my shattered, hemorrhaging heart and the possibility of rebuilding the wastelands of my wounded relationships. I began seeking out any and all opportunities to change my thinking, behavior, habits, and friendships. I started with the only available option, volunteer-ran religious groups. There I got the much-needed support and healing, and I found people who turned out to be expert listeners. I also learned the effective power of prayer. It revolutionized my life. Although getting into programs while in prison have insane challenges, I developed a set of skills in self-advocating. I also managed to get into drug treatment before leaving, which is a miracle in itself. With only 60 beds amongst a bulging population of nearly 1,300 souls. Upon release, I made every effort to investigate the ins and outs of several agencies, including mental health ones, to see if they could assist me. I discovered many unconventional approaches to accessing services. I've always been creative in utilizing resources, but not quite in this way. With each completed program, I began to feel measurable increments of grief and disorientation slough off as the real me began to emerge. Who was this vibrant and dynamic woman standing before me? What an honor to meet you, my dear. Long time coming. I'm so taken aback that I have been able to defy the odds and find some semblance of peace in my life. in some sort of way. One thing my mom failed to mention, because she thinks it's irrelevant, is that her biological parents, yes, she was adopted, had 15 children, and they sold 10 as a means of supporting themselves. Plus, they were alcoholics, we later found out. What unimaginable trauma they must have faced was certainly passed down to the both of us in some way, genetically, and could possibly explain some of the struggles that we both have in our lives. My mom often says I take life way too seriously, that I'm too uptight. I call it being conscientiously cautious. I also know that I could fall off the wagon with any combination of missteps and need to be extremely vigilant about red flag behaviors that would harm me if left unchecked. Since discovering the truer, more effective version of myself, I've been able to accomplish quite a few things. After living in a shelter for 4 months, I was able to get housing and my three kids back. There, the real work had to begin. I got all of us in counseling, something that I was always taught to never trust the system. It was an extremely hard barrier to overcome, how to trust again, or how to trust in the first place. And me and my children have to work constantly towards healing. And I've done a great deal of maturing alongside of them. I can proudly say I've got 3 high school graduates. I was also able to get state certified as a peer mentor through the Oregon Health Authority. With the extent of my legal history, it's unimaginable that I could get state certified for anything. But I come to find out that our lived experience is one of the most valuable things we can offer to the next person who's struggling or trying to find recovery for themselves. And with this certification, like some of these people back here, I can work in treatment centers. I'm also certified to work with youth and young adult, and I can even work in correctional facilities. You can imagine that. I have a friend who's a peer mentor who works in a county jail. Also, I'd love to work in any of those capacities, but for now I've chosen a career in the trades, and I'm currently working as an electrician with the IBEW, where I'm an active union member learning why organized labor is important. I'm also on the advisory board of the Oregon Justice Resource Center, a nonprofit organization that fights for justice system reform. I've been invited back to the prison several times to share my testimony and provide information about reentry. In addition to that, I do a lot of volunteering and outreach for organizations who are part of my success story, such as Red Lodge Transition Service, who helps Native Americans inside the prison and returning back to the community from prison, and Mercy Corps Reentry Transition Center, another remarkable reentry organization. Also, supported by Southeast Works and the Prisoner Reentry Program, I was able to complete Constructing Hope, which is a pre-apprenticeship program that target minorities and people with legal histories to find careers in the trades. Through all of this, one of the most useful things I've been able to learn is the transforming power of volunteering and how it helps me, not just others. I also learned the simple thing known as how to ask for help, which was a foreign concept to me and truly uncomfortable to me, to not be able to provide something back to someone when I ask for something. If I explain that right, I'm still getting used to this one, asking for help. Well, you've heard some pretty amazing things from some pretty amazing people here this afternoon. My question to all of you is this: what have you heard today that will compel you to take action, to partner with us, and keep the positive momentum in our lives flowing in the right direction? You have heard how we have fought upstream and went through incredible feats of self-discovery. What might you be willing to offer us in the way of advice, mentoring, or other opportunities. We have a reception after the performance where if you're able to stay, please come shake a hand, meet a friend, and invite us into your lives. We are your neighbors. Thank you.
You are listening to Prison Pipeline from KBOO Portland. You just heard Long Time Coming by Jackie from the performance Shaping a Future, Life After Prison. Next, I'll be speaking with JoJo Donovan and Josh Cook about the event Demanding Justice, Storytelling to End Police Violence, and the movement to put pressure on current and future district attorneys in Oregon. JoJo, would you start with telling us about the movement Oregon DA for the People?
Yes, absolutely. So I came to the Oregon DA for the People campaign through showing up for racial justice. Their Black Lives Matter action group has been partnering with a group called Pacific Northwest Family Circle for a while now. Surge, showing up for racial justice, is a group of white folks organizing other white folks to address issues of racial justice and work towards the destruction of white supremacy. Pacific Northwest Family Circle is a group of families who have lost loved ones to police murder, and we've partnered with them for a long time. And as Surge was starting to make a shift from work they had been doing around more sort of base building and working with cultural organizing with other white folks towards a shift of doing more campaign work and sort of leveraging the power and privilege that we have as white folks to support our people of color led community partners. We went to Pacific Northwest Family Circle and sort of asked what their priorities were and where they would like us to sort of direct our energy in putting together a campaign. And what surfaced from them was really wanting to put pressure on district attorneys, who are figures that hold immense power in the local criminal, legal, and punishment system. They're sort of behind the scenes figures in a lot of ways. And if they're talked about at all, it's sort of as like this white knight figure that's sort of defending the public from the bad guys. But the experiences that families have had with prosecutors after losing their loved ones is that the district attorney tends to use the power of that office to shield police from any consequences after extrajudicial killings or any other instances of police violence.
Could you say briefly what the district attorney's role is?
Sure. So the district attorney touches a lot of different parts of the criminal legal system, but their primary function is to determine who will get charged with a crime and sort of what those charges look like, whether there are plea deals. They're responsible for handing over evidence to the defense. So they have a lot of say and power and sort of what goes on within both the prosecuting in a district and also within policing, because if they decline to prosecute certain types of crimes, that influences then who the police go out and what crimes they're looking for. They do a lot to sort of set the culture of what policing and prosecuting looks like within their jurisdiction. Every county has their own district attorney that they elect. So in our campaign right now, we're focusing primarily on the Multnomah County election in 2020, where Rod Underhill has been our district attorney for a long time and mostly run unopposed, which is very common. District attorneys and attorneys' offices in general are mostly immune from any sort of legal consequences, even when there is malpractice. So the only real way to hold a district attorney accountable is through the vote. So because it's an elected position, there's a chance if we push for more progressive candidates who value what we value and want to end mass incarceration, there can be significant shifts, but it has to come from elections and from people voicing those priorities. Our primary approach right now is more around, one, educating the public around the role that the district attorney plays, the harm that's caused within that office, and then with our partner organizations, primarily Pacific Northwest Family Circle and Phoenix Rising, we've been developing a platform of demands for, as the election progresses and as people enter the race, a list of demands for what we would want to see from a district attorney, both in terms of sort of short-term harm reduction, ways that prosecuting practices can be less harmful to our communities and work against criminalization, while also holding sort of a longer-term vision for abolition, where what we're looking for is to build the power. It's more than just an election, building sort of a movement of folks who are ready to sort of shape the conversation around what justice and accountability looks like.
Cool. Tell us about the event that's coming up on Wednesday in Portland, Oregon.
Sure. So this will be a sort of storytelling event, bringing together families from Pacific Northwest Family Circles, sharing stories about their loved ones that they've lost to police violence, starting the process of demanding justice and sort of kicking off our campaign in that way. It'll be at Portland State. And then, Josh, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more, so since you'll be on the panel, about sort of what you'll be bringing.
Yeah, we're also going to be including people that have been, or at least myself, who's been previously incarcerated, who's seen the other side of the, you know, the power that the DA has in how people are getting sentenced and the types of choices they have when being presented with their charges. Yeah. Typically, they stack a lot of charges and scare people into taking a plea deal so that it never even reaches a judge. And it seems to be a pretty common practice in other states as well, but with our Measure 11 set up the way it is, it affects youths primarily. And a bill was passed recently that might change some of that, but you know, that's still affecting the 18 to 20 year old demographic that ends up getting in front of a judge. So I'm hoping to be able to share my story and present that side of things, since there are a lot of factors that come into how this campaign is going to affect not just the people who are, you know, the victims of police brutality, but you know, the people that are ending up incarcerated in prison, the other side of them being prosecuted by the DA.
The event is Demanding Justice, Storytelling to End Police Violence and Incarceration. It'll be on Wednesday, June 5th from 7 to 9 p.m. in Park Mill at Portland State University in room 183. The address is 1633 Southwest Park Avenue. There will be kiddos welcome, so we'll have childcare available as well as food for anyone who attends. It will be ADA accessible. And if you want to learn more and find out about our event, you can go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/OregonDA for the people, and you can find out more about our event there, as well as ongoing ways to get plugged into our movement to hold the district attorney accountable.
You've been listening to Prison Pipeline from KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to Jackie for allowing me to feature your monologue tonight. Thank you to all the participants of Shaping a Future Life After Prison. This was the final episode. Thank you, Jojo Donovan and Josh Cook. And thank you to our engineer, Joseph Lyons.